And welcome to the classical physics course. I'm David. I'll be lecturing this course. We will also have a guest lecturer in the third week, Minu, and she will tell you about classical chaos and very complicated things I don't understand. So the plan is basically to give you some background for what is to follow. And I hope that most of what I'm going to tell you is just a repetition for you. So, you know, we will start with analytical mechanics, so with classical mechanics, Euler Lagrange equations, action principle, and stuff like that. And so that should definitely be a repetition. But we will also touch on some more advanced subjects like Hamilton-Jacobi theory. Maybe not everybody actually seen it. I will mention what does it mean that the system is integrable, and, you know, whether you can actually solve every system in terms of integrals of motion and stuff like that. And then I will move to special relativity and field theory. And of course, the cornerstone of modern physics is Maxwell's theory. So you know, I will spend a lot of time on, you know, reviewing some basic concepts in Maxwell's theory. And then I will also tell you some alternatives and some extensions of Maxwell's theory. So we will discuss as an alternative Feynman-Wheeler's theory, which is a theory without fields, actually. But it describes the same electromagnetism as we know it. And then we will discuss some, you know, generalizations, non-linear generalizations of Maxwell theory, such as Born-Infeld theory and so on. So here's the outline for you on that first sheet of paper. Now it should be pretty clear what you are supposed to do. You are supposed to attend the tutorials and work collaboratively. And you are supposed to hand out the homeworks in time. And then you are supposed to pass the interview at the end of the course. So now I mentioned, so there will be a PSI study text. It is available on your learning platform. It looks like this. So you can download it from there, and you can print it or whatever if you want to. But of course, I am not forcing you to read my text. There is many amazing classic books on what we are going to discuss. So let me mention just Landau and Lifshitz Mechanics and Classical Field Theory, so two beautiful books. If you are interested in mathematical concepts of analytical mechanics, then I encourage you to read Arnold's book, Mathematical Methods of Classical Mechanics. For special relativity, Carol's book, Space Time and Geometry, an Introduction to General Relativity, like the first few chapters, would be relevant. We will touch a little bit on string theory, but maybe like 10 minutes. But anyway, you can start reading Zwiebach, first course in string theory, if you are interested. If you are interested in, you know, quantizing gravity and, you know, how the Hamiltonian picture actually, how to deal with constraints and how to, you know, deal with gauge theories in the Hamiltonian picture, there's a beautiful, very, very small book by Dirac, Lectures on Quantum Mechanics. It's like 80 pages, and then there's everything there you need to know about quantizing gravity. And then finally, I really like this Thomas Ortin's book, Gravity and Strings. And so it's a very, very good background for the course. And so on. But in general, it's a very, very good book, which gives you a good background into things. Are there any questions so far? Everybody's scared, that's good. All right, so let's just jump into that. And so Lagrangian mechanics is deal with is a simple Lagrangian, just a scalar quantity which describes the entire system. And given that Lagrangian, you can actually derive everything you need to know about the system. So part A will be Hamilton's principle. Principle of least action. And so really the great idea of this Lagrangian mechanics is to not overdo it. So you know, if you have a system, let's say a pendulum, so then you may be wondering, well, there's a pendulum, it's moving in 2D space, so I need to use two coordinates to describe my pendulum. But that's of course not true as long as the length of the pendulum is not changing. So in that case, actually there's only one dynamical degree of freedom, and you can choose it to be the angle where the pendulum is. Right? So the first step when you are actually dealing with, you know, Lagrangian mechanics and whatever, is to choose the right generalized coordinates. And so these need not to be, you know, the Cartesian coordinates, x, y, z, and whatever, but they are just the convenient coordinates which describe, you know, fully your motion, and they can capture all situations where the motion can happen. And so the trick is really to choose that many of them as there are degrees of freedom. So if you are choosing more than that, there will be some constraints in the system, and you don't want that. You have to deal with the constraints then, right? So you know, and there's as many as number of degrees of freedom. Yes?
Sorry, what did you write there?
It's a QI, where let's say I goes from, let me put this way, QI, I goes from 1 to n if we have n degrees of freedom, let's say. Okay, so this is my strange Q, sorry for that. Okay, let me elaborate on this. Is it better? No, it's the same, right? QI. So these are the generalized coordinates. Right? And so really the trick is to choose as many as the numbers of degrees of freedom. If you choose more, then there will be some constraint, then you have to deal with the constraint. And then of course, you know, that can be done. And sometimes it's useful, but many times it just complicates things. Okay? And so as many as degrees of freedom, to fully describe the system, to fully describe each picture, the system picture of the system. And so we know that the picture of the system, so like where the particle is and stuff like that, is described in the configuration space. So the configuration space. Of course, you know that if you have a point in the configuration space, which means like I just described where the system is, that really doesn't tell me where the system moves next, right? So you need to know the velocities or the momenta in order to describe. So you need a position and velocity to describe fully the system, the dynamics. But the configuration space really cares only about where the system is at that point. And so this is precisely, so the dimensionality of the configuration space is n in this case here. All right, so that's the first thing. So you choose the generalized coordinates. The second thing is that you realize that you need not to think about the system as an initial value problem, right? So typically, you have the initial value problem. And that is, you know, I have my time evolution t, and this is my generalized moment. I'm just omitting the index I for the moment. I can always return it back. And then you know that the system evolves like that. And in order, so this will be Q at t. And this is t1, some initial time t1. And then I can specify what q1, which is q at t1, is. And what q1 dot is q dot at t1 is. And so that will be the initial value problem, right? So in order to know how my system evolves, I start at some point, I specify where the system is, what is its initial velocity, and then I just evolve from there to the future, right? So that's one way to think about that. And so that's very natural in Newtonian physics. But there's another way, which I call boundary, which is not really a boundary value problem, but anyway, value problem. And so basically what you need to do always is specify two data, right? So you have some equations of motion, which are typically second order equations of motion. And in order to fix the integration constants, you need to specify two data. So here I'm choosing the initial position and initial velocity. But the other possibility is that you choose the initial position, q1, at t1, and the final position, q2, at t2. Okay, and so that will be the boundary value problem. Again, I am providing two data, so I can fix my integration constants. And so this will be the alternative to that. So we will be dealing with this way of formulation, because that's very suitable for, you know, that's how this works. But it's also very good for quantum mechanics. So typically you are interested, like, you know, I measure the particle here, I measure it later, what happened in between, right? So this is quite natural. It's natural in quantum mechanics. All right, so now we understand everything. So we'll be using the second description here. And so let's formulate the theorem. And it's due to Hamilton. Okay, so theorem, principle. So please, if you have any questions, just jump into that, right? So ask any questions. There are no stupid questions, only stupid answers, and I will give you lots of stupid answers. So be ready for that, okay? Principle of least action. And this is due to Hamilton. And it says that the motion of mechanical system. But of course, this will be true much more generally. It will be true for fields as well. As long as we are, you know, stay at the classical level, it will be true for the classical field theory and so on. So not only mechanical system, but let's do it first for the mechanical system in time interval t, which belongs between t1 and t2. So really, I'm fixing what happens at t1, what happens at t2, and then I'm asking what happened in between. Coincides with the extremal extremum of the action functional. Okay, and so what is the action functional? Well, typically it's denoted by S. It's a function of a function, so that's why it's called functional. Yes?
Yeah, to jump back for a second, sorry. The right one over there, the right plot, why is that one natural in quantum mechanics? Why not the left one?
Well, I mean, you can probably do both, I don't know. But typically, you know, in quantum mechanics, right? So what you are doing is that you measure something at one time, and then you measure it later, right? And so then you're asking, well, how this could happen, right? So yeah, I would say that's yeah. Yeah.
The first one is a little bit more deterministic, I think, right? Because you measure the coordinates at the particular time, you know where it's going to go from there, but the second one, you have no idea what the direction is, but if you just you just measure the coordinates in two different times.
I think so. And another point would be that, you know, here you basically have to specify like the momenta and the position at the beginning, which you cannot do in quantum mechanics, really. So that's why, you know, so they you know, yeah. I would say that the second one is better. Okay, so action functional. So functional means it's a function of a function. So it's a function of my trajectory of the particle. Okay, and this is an integral from t1 to t2 dt of L q dot and t dt. And so this L here is called Lagrangian. And, you know, specifying what this Lagrangian is, so it's a function of this Q and Q dot and T possibly, and specifying this Lagrangian corresponds to the choice of the system or description of the system. So once you are given a Lagrangian, you know everything about the system, and the statement is the system evolves so that, you know, this action functional actually extremized. Okay, so that's beautiful, isn't it? So really what you need to know is just to know this one function here, and then you know everything. And that's a great improvement, you know, with respect to Newtonian physics, where you have to really deal with the forces, how they are oriented. Forces are vectors, so you have many more numbers, and it's, you know, much more complicated. All right, so how does it work?
That always assumes there is one extremum between T1 and T2.
That's a good question. So that could be more. So this is a mirror, right? And then I shoot light from here, right? So let's say I want to shoot light, and I want to measure it back, right? So I have many, many, many options like how to do that, right? So there will be another option like that, another option like that. So this is sort of like discontinuous. I have some sharp edges here, but maybe you could make it continuous. So that could be in principle more extrema. And I think that, you know, they typically correspond to more trajectories, but some of them, well, this one will be shorter, this one will be longer, and so on, right? So you know, you can have more extrema. This is a stupid example. I didn't say that, okay? Okay, so how does it work? So of course, you know, this is nice, but we need some equations of motion derived from here. And so we'll precisely use this, you know, second way how to do that. So we will consider basically like fix and problem. So we will specify what happens at T1, what happens at T2. Where the particle is, and then you consider all the trajectories in between, and then we somehow miraculously choose the one which extremizes this action. Okay, so to derive equations of motion, consider this, you know, boundary value problem, so the fixed endpoints. So we have that really we specify where it is. So if you do variation of that, if you choose some, well, that's zero. Delta Q T1 is zero, and delta Q T2 is zero. So we're fixing where the system is at T1 and T2. And then this is the picture. So we know where the system is at T1. We know where the system is at T2. But then we consider all the possible trajectories in between. So let me just draw two of them. And then if you are in time t, somewhere here, then, you know, the first trajectory, one, will have q of t. That's a trajectory one. This is trajectory 2. And then the second trajectory will have q of t. But because we are considering just nearby trajectories, it will be q of t plus delta q of t. OK? So at this point here will be q of t plus delta q of t, where I consider delta q of t to be small. So now we want to extremize the action. So we require that the variation of the action is equal to zero. But what is the variation? It's precisely S Q of T plus delta Q of T minus S Q of T. And this we require to be zero. And that's That's the miracles principle, which chooses us the trajectory here. Okay. So now comes a very strange path from a physics point of view. If you do actually do the, properly define what this variational, what this derivative means, really the functional derivative means, then the mathematical formulation is very clear and explains why happens what I just will write down happens. But from physics point of view, it's also very interesting and very intuition is great. So now what we are doing is that we are basically doing two things. We are moving forward in time, so there will be like dt time here. So we have a time derivative at our disposal, d over dt, right? But we also have this strange variation. What this strange variation is doing is that for a fixed time, it just changes, the value of the trajectory from one value to another one. So basically, the delta thing is moving in this direction here, and the d over dt thing is moving in that direction over there. And that's true, of course, at every point, at every time, right? So it shouldn't be surprising that actually these two things, because they are orthogonal, they actually commute with each other. Okay, so what I'm trying to say is that this is true. Okay, orthogonal direction. So basically, the variation delta has nothing to do with time. And so that's why this identity is true. Yes?
So in the S of Q plus delta Q, is there a dot over the second?
No. I'm sorry. No. It shouldn't be. It's just you take the trajectory, Q prime of T minus S of Q of T. All right. And so this identity should be true for anything, right? So as I say, if you don't like this explanation that it's like orthogonal and it has nothing to do with each other, then you can go to a mathematical rigorous formulation of what this functional derivative really means. And then it's obvious that really, the delta variation has nothing to do with the time evolution. So anyway, so equipped with this, we can just do the one-line calculation to derive our equations of motion. So we require delta s equals to 0. Well, very good. So what is s? It's just an integral from t1 to t2. So again, delta has nothing to do with time. So all we have to vary inside, so we have integral of l dt, but delta doesn't do anything this time. Okay, so we just do dl, delta l, and then dt, right? So we don't differentiate dt. Compare this when you will discuss the Noether's theorem. That will be much more complicated, okay? Okay, very good. So now we treat this delta as a normal derivative. So t1, t2. So l depends on q and q dot. So it will be dl over dq delta q plus, like calculating a total differential, dq dot delta q dot, and then dt. I'm not doing dl over dt partial one, because delta has nothing to do with that. Okay, very good. And so now the most important thing you have to be able to integrate by parts. So this is delta of d over dt of q, right? But because of that identity, I can swap them. So this is the same thing as d over dt of delta q, right? So now I have time derivative of this thing here, and I can move this time derivative onto the other term, right? So very good. So this is equal to some integrated by parts, and so we have dl over dq, and then it's minus d over dt. I'm moving the time derivative from this term onto that term, so minus d over dt dl over dq dot delta q dt, and plus a boundary term dl over dq dot delta q from t1 to t2. So just, you know, shifting this derivative here onto that term over there. Okay. And so we are done. So we require this is equal to zero. Okay. So we are lucky this term here. It's just delta q evaluated at t1 or t2. But because we have fixed endpoints, that vanishes. So the boundary term is zero. And then, you know, in order this to be zero, of course, you are integrating something complicated. This is arbitrary. So the only possibility is that this whole bracket here is equal to zero. And so we derive the Euler Lagrange equations, dr over dq minus d over dt, dl over dq dot equals to zero, which are the famous Euler Lagrange equations. Hallelujah, amazing result. Again, this will be true in the field theory as well. You just have to replace, you know, the coordinates with the fields, and then it will be exactly the same derivation goes for the field theory. Questions so far? Yes?
In this theorem, you don't really differentiate between the maximum or the minimum point of the action, right? Is there a significance of the maximum or the minimum points?
I don't know. So certainly what I know is that for some systems, you are looking for the minimum. For some systems, you are looking for the maximum. The simplest example, well, extremum. The simplest example of extremum where this is not a minimum is the free relativistic particle, as you will see it. So basically, you will see that the action is just an integral over the proper time of the particle. And you know that what you actually want to do is that you want to maximize the proper time, not minimize the proper time. That's better. Okay, we will come back to that later. So there are certain examples where this is not a minimum, I don't know. Yeah, I wonder if it has something to do with stability, but probably not. I didn't say anything. More questions.
Is it meaningful to just negate the whole Lagrangian in that case?
I mean, if you negate things, it doesn't change anything, right? So you just use the Lagrangian to formulate this thing here. But it doesn't change whether it's like the longest trajectory or the shortest trajectory. Just pick up a minor or minus sign, but the Euler Lagrange equations remain the same, right? So that doesn't help you.
But I mean, I can just make, like, you could say it's just a minimum, and whenever it's going to be a maximum,
like a minimum negative, whatever. Yeah, I don't feel that this is right, but I don't know. I will have to see. Okay, a few remarks. So, first, so here we were considering the case when Lagrangian was function of q, q dot, and t. So in this case, if you look at the equation over here, what order is this equation? So L is a function of Q and Q dot. So generally, what order? Like differential equation of first order?
Second
order, perfect. So we have like, and then if you have n degrees of freedom, so I would put an index I here, right? So then you would have n equations of motion, right? So then we have n second order equations of motion for our system. So now you will have lots of fun during the first tutorial to see what happens. And actually, I start putting more derivatives here. All right, so there are some theories and people consider crazy things. So you know, what happens if I put q double dot or something like that? And what order will be your resulting equation of motion? Can you still solve it and stuff like that? So you will play with that in tutorial. So second remark, it can be shown that, you know, if you have simple mechanical systems and four fields, it works as well. Is that basically is a prescription how to calculate this L if you know, you know, what is the kinetic energy and what is the potential energy of the system, right? And so in that case, it can be shown that L is just T minus V. This is the kinetic energy, and this is the potential. Okay, and so this is beautifully derived in Landau and Lipschitz, so I encourage you to read that. So see Landau and Lipschitz, the first volume. Okay, so if you have simple system, you know, where you can formulate what the kinetic energy of the system is, what the potential energy is, then this Lagrangian is actually T minus V. It's not T plus V, it's not a total energy, rather it's T minus V. Okay. Perhaps the most important remark is that, you know, this whole thing here is not entirely unique. And what can happen is that I can specify L, but there is some other L which leads to the same equations of motion. So what is the freedom here? And the freedom is simple. You can go from L to L prime, which is by L, you know, let's put just to make sure it's a. So my L is a function of Q dot and T. So now I can go to new L prime plus a total time derivative of a function which depends on Q and T only, not Q dot here, over dt, is the freedom. Is the freedom in description. So Lagrangian is not unique. I can always go from, you know, the old Lagrangian, and I can add total time derivative of some function, which is a function of Q and T only. It cannot be a function of Q dot. That's very important. Okay. So how do you prove this? Well, one way is to say, well, okay, I just plug it into these equations of motion. I plug there new L prime, right, and see that these terms actually drop out. And then I will end up with the same equation as for L, right? So that's by brute force, and it's definitely true, and it's simple. Let me just do maybe a little bit more sneaky but simpler way to do that. So proof of this is that, well, let's consider S prime, which is my integral of L prime dt, which of course is an integral of the old L dt plus an integral d lambda dt dt. Okay, which of course this is S. Okay. So now if I do the variation of S prime, okay, so that will be the variation of S plus, okay, so now. Okay, let me write it. Okay, so it's delta of d lambda over dt dt, right? But I can use this miraculous identity again. I can swap delta and d over dt, right? So this thing here is d over dt delta lambda integral dt. Okay. But it's a total derivative of something integrated between t1 and t2. So it's a boundary term, right? So this thing here is just a boundary term of d of delta lambda. But what is delta lambda, right? So delta lambda is t lambda over dq delta q. And then I would have, if lambda were a function of q dot as well, then I would have another term. I would have delta lambda over dq dot delta q dot, but it's not, okay? So this is it. There's nothing else. It's just this thing here, right? But of course, I still have my fixed endpoints, right? So this thing here is zero, okay? So this guy is zero, and so that's why this thing here is just equal to delta s, okay? So because of the fixed endpoints, this is zero. But of course, if I, you know, I wanted to try putting lambda as a function of q dot, I would have another term here. I would have delta lambda over dq dot, delta q dot, but delta q dot at the boundary is not zero. It can be anything, right? And so that wouldn't be true. So really what is really, really important is that there's no Q dot here. Okay? That's very, very important. So the freedom is there, but it's so you are able to add time derivative, total time derivative, a function of Q and T, but not of Q dot. Right? All right. Questions? Yes.
So in the line delta, or yeah, delta s prime equals delta s plus that term.
Yes.
The total derivative d lambda by dt, wouldn't that include a partial lambda, partial t as well term? How does that?
So remember the delta. So is this strange variation delta, right? But it's nothing to do with t, right? So in the same way as we were deriving the equations of motion here, so when we are doing delta l, right? We are doing dl over dq, dl over dq dot. But there's no delta. So basically, delta t equals to zero in this variation. Because when we are varying things, we fix time. We don't do anything with time. We just change, you know, this direction here. Right? So delta is such that delta t is equal to zero always. OK? Good that you ask, because we will do, in a few minutes, a variation where delta t, delta tilde t will not be equal to zero, right? But
can we say that s and s prime will correspond to the same path?
It equals to?
They'll correspond to the same trajectory, s and s prime.
Yeah, exactly. So the statement is, I can grow from the old Lagrangian to a totally new one, and this is, you know, very, very, you know, big freedom, right? I can take any function of q and t, and the statement is, if I do that, my trajectories will not change. These equations will remain the same, right? And so there's the freedom. The trajectories do not change. Nothing changes. What will change though is that you're adding a total time derivative term. So if you calculate Noether's charge or whatever, so the new L prime will give you a different Noether's charge. Okay.
So I was a little bit confused about the principle of least action. Call it the principle of least action, but we say that the system is extremum, right?
Yeah.
So I can understand when it's maximum or minimum, because when it's maximum, you could just times it by -1, and you would say it's all about it. So you're just calculating the minimum again when it's maximum. But because extremum also includes a saddle point.
Yeah, yeah.
What's up with that?
Yeah, I think there are examples where actually it is neither maximum or minimum. But I don't know the example of my hand. It's confusing, right? It's called principle of least action, right? But really, it should be like extremal action, right? And so really, it's important that you know, you consider extremum, but it doesn't have to be necessarily minimum or.
You said that you can't thought of any example with the saddle point?
I think so. There are examples. Is that possible? Possible. Give me an example next time, okay?
I've always wondered, do you know how Hamilton maybe like came up with his theorem?
There were lots of things which preceded these things, right? And so I would say, you know, most of them coming from physics. So there was Fermat's principle, right? Where they knew how, you know, the light is actually propagating, and you know, it's basically like an extremal principle for light. Right, and so there were like several, you know, things were known before this, right? But this is much more general, right?
Is there a physical significance of the second variation of the action?
Second variation of the action.
Because it would then differentiate between the maximum and minimum one.
Yeah. So yeah, that was just yeah. Let's not go there. I think it has to do with the stability and things like that, but. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. Okay. Also, you know, the answer is Hamilton was genius, right? So all right. So part B, and that will be about the integrals of motion. Okay. So now we have our equations of motion. And we better be able to solve them, right? But that's typically not easy. So you have some second order you know, equations of motion. You have n of them, and can I solve them? And the answer is most often not. So you know, what people do is that they try to solve them numerically, right? So numerically, you can always solve them if you specify, you know, some proper data. You can solve them. You can also solve them approximately, right? So it's, let's say I solved the Keplerian motion using the Kepler law, and I have an ellipse. I know that in Einstein's theory, I don't no longer have ellipse. I have something which is, you know, precessing or whatever. So you can do a small perturbation around an ellipse. In fact, for Mercury, you can actually do a small perturbation around the circle, right? And so you know, so you can do. So typically solving equation of motion, you can do numerically always. You can do, well, if the system is well posed, of course. Numerically, you can do perturbatively. But sometimes you are lucky and you can actually integrate them. So analytically. So interestingly, that's what people know. It's always, you know, they encounter in their undergraduate studies systems which are actually can be analytically solved, like harmonic oscillator. In fact, that's the only system which can really be solved. And so this can be only done in very, very special cases, and it's cases of integrable systems. Which basically look like harmonic oscillator. So I will tell you much later what these integrable systems are. But basically, in order the system to be integrable, it has to have sufficient number of nice integrals of motion. Okay, so this is in case of, you know, lots of integrals of motion. So what is an integral of motion? So definition. An integral of motion, sometimes it's called also a constant of motion, motion is a function, let's call it I, and that will be a function of q, q dot, and t. So an integral constant of motion and q obeys di over dt equals to 0 for any u of t solving equations of motion. So, you know, once we are, well, I'll just introduce this notion in a minute, but once we are on shell, once we are actually satisfying equations of motion, then if you can find a new function, which is a function of q, q dot, and t, such that its total derivative with respect to time is equal to 0, then you found an integral of motion. Simple example, you have a free particle, the free particle moves freely, and the momentum is conserved. So the momentum is an integral of motion, okay? Or the energy is conserved, that's another integral. All right? So this is only true as long as the equations of motion are satisfied, okay? Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense to talk about integral of motion. All right, so now there's this beautiful result. Which is called Noether's theorem. It's actually many Noether's theorems, but in this course, we will concentrate only on one. But we will have 15 different versions of this theorem. So, okay, and it will be about the integrals of motion. So let's put it version one, and let's call it a general version. And so, what it actually says, this theorem, is that somehow the existence of these integrals of motion is linked to the properties, to the geometry of the configuration space, to the symmetries of the configuration space. Okay, and so that's actually a very, very profound result. because in some sense you are actually connecting, you know, something about the motion with the geometry, right? So you geometrize physics suddenly. So if you study, you know, the geometry of the configuration space, you can actually say, well, the motion will be integrable. I can say lots of things about the motion. So anyway, so let's state what this theorem says. So for every global continuous symmetry, of system, there is a corresponding integral of motion. So very, very profound result. Okay. And so what is even more funny about this result is that, of course, this result was formulated at the beginning of the 20th century, I think. And still people don't understand what was actually written in these papers. And they keep publishing new papers about, you know, generalizations of this Noether theorem and stuff like that. But if you look at the original papers, actually all these generalizations are already there. Okay, so really, you know, they're really formulated the most general result in a beautiful way, but also in a way that people are still struggling to, you know, see the full consequences of this. So anyway, so this is geometrizes physics. Because now we are actually, you know, connecting symmetries and properties with the properties of the motion. Yes?
Okay, I'm a little bit confused. How is it possible that there can be several integrals of motion? Because when you fix q and q dot at c, I would say there's
one. Sorry. So you know, there is an index I here, right? So you have many degrees of freedom, right? And so I'm always writing like just q and q dot, but you know, as many degrees of freedom as you need, right? And so then the statement is, if you have system with n degrees of freedom, at most you can have 2n minus 1 integrals of motion which are independent and stuff like that. Okay, so there'll be, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
But you know, that many comes from that index I. If you have one dimensional system, energy is always conserved and then,
just a follow-up question. If we can generalize coordinate, then we will have new integrals of motion. Like we can have new integrals and new constants with
So you know, having an integral of motion is a property of the system. Okay? So it's completely independent of which coordinates you are using or whatever. Of course, you know, it may be the case that in some coordinate system, you obviously see, well, there is this integral of motion. If you now change, you know, coordinates to some crazy coordinates, it will not be obvious at all that there will be that integral of motion, right? So the statement is like there's always, you know, that many integrals of motion. They are characteristic of the system, and this is independent of the coordinates, right? But you know, changing coordinates, I may discover this integral of motion easily. Changing, you know, to another coordinate system, I discover a different integral of motion easily, and so on. So it is an art finding, you know, integrals of motion, right? And that, you know, is it typically involves playing with various coordinate systems and stuff like that. But you know, existence of an integral of motion is independent of coordinates.
Okay, so there is no particular algorithm to find the integrals of motion, for example. It is pretty obvious in some points, let's say we have angular momentum conservation or something like that, but that comes from the physical understanding of physics. So there is no algorithm to know exactly what
the okay, you're asking a very good question. So the answer is basically yes and no. So I'll give you a prescription how to do that, but the answer is there's no algorithm. Okay, and the reason, well, and there's only, you know, few examples of integrable systems known in all history, you know. And so if you find an integrable system, if you find, you know, things like that, then you are famous and the integrable system is named after you and so on, and then people read about you in books and stuff like that, right? So it's very, very difficult to show, you know, what the integrals of motion are for the system. You know, now we have a computer, right? So you can always solve the equations of motion numerically, and then you can look at the solutions. And do the solutions actually look integrable, or do they look chaotic, right? If they look chaotic, I know there's not enough integrals of motion, right? And so I better not spend my lifetime trying to find one, right? But yeah, it's complicated.
If you put it in the computer and spit out some equations, and you could probably find the equations of the integrals of motion from that, or could be a little bit more...
No. It's just, you know, looking at the solutions, right? I can see, is my motion chaotic? If it's chaotic, I don't have enough integrals of motion to integrate it, right? And so people were sometimes, before the computers were invented, people didn't know, like you are given the Lagrangian, right? Is it integrable? Does it have integrals of motion and so on? I don't know, right? So then they were trying to change coordinates and find new integrals of motion, and yeah.
So by symmetries, here we mean symmetries of the equation of motion, right? At the Lagrangian.
Sorry, you mean this global continuous symmetry? Okay, let me just elaborate on this. Very good. So in order to explain what global continuous symmetry means, let me introduce some terminology. So first, it's a very useful terminology. So terminology. So now the first terminology is like, let's use it, on-shell or off-shell. Okay, so the statement is valid. So statement valid. And now it's either on-shell or off-shell. And you know, you will see this terminology in quantum field theory as well, but whatever. So you know, the statement is valid on-shell means that, you know, provided equations of motion are satisfied. And it is valid off shell, I don't need anything. But it's simply true. True no matter what. Okay. So in quantum field theory, you will see that the photon is on shell when actually it satisfies equations of motion. It means when it's massless and whatever, right? But anyway, so on shell statement means it's only valid, you know, provided the equations of motion are satisfied, provided I can use my Euler Lagrange equations to prove the statement. Yes.
So you said something's off shell. That's true no matter what. So can it be off shell while being on shell?
Okay, so certainly, you know, if the statement is valid off shell, it will be also valid on shell, right? Because it's no matter what. Yeah. Okay, so that's first terminology. The second terminology, yes? You have it? No? Okay, so now the second terminology regards the types of symmetries. And then I introduce this horrible notation, which I don't like. Okay, anyway. So let's be very concrete and consider some, you know, concrete transformation. So consider a transformation so I go from t to t prime, which is my t plus delta t. And then from q to q prime of t prime, which is q of t plus delta q of t. So this is a transformation which we'll be concerned about. So now beware, okay? So I'm using delta tilde now, not delta. It's a different delta than in the equations of motion. It's just a transformation that I'm allowed to change time here, okay? I'm changing time, and I'm changing my generalized coordinates as well, right? And so this delta tilde is slightly different than the delta, because that delta had fixed t, always.
Should the q prime of t, should that be t prime? And if so, should we have primes in the other t's?
So this is q prime of t prime, which is q of t plus delta q of t.
So we wouldn't have q of t prime plus delta t prime?
What I'm really considering is infinitesimal transformation,
okay.
Right? And so you know, I can change, you know, t prime or whatever to t, and that will be of the higher order. So once I have, you know, delta tilde q, I can write of t, but I can also write t prime, doesn't matter, because, you know, the correction will be of higher order. All right? So in the end, you know, so let's write it, consider, well, okay, let's just keep it as it is. So let me just really stress what, you know, the difference between the two variations is. And so this is a very important picture to have in mind when you think about Noether's theorem, because you are allowed to change time and the variation there is different than the variation in the equations of motion. So let me just again do the equations of motion setup, which we discussed before. So this is q, this is t. And then I am fixing the boundaries and do the variations, and do the variations in such a way that for fixed time, I do the delta q, right? So there is fixed endpoints. So this is the variation delta, okay? And so we know everything about that, and it's very natural and whatever. So now this delta tilde is different. So now I have again q. So now this is the Noether setup. So now we consider the variation delta tilde. Okay. So now I consider two nearby trajectories. But these two nearby trajectories need not have to have fixed endpoints. It's just I consider one trajectory, and I consider a different trajectory, and I can move the endpoints. Okay. For example, if I translate something in time, right, so that I know that, you know, there should be conserved energy and stuff like that. If you transfer something in time, well, typically, well, everything moves in time forward, right? And so there is no fixed endpoints. Everything moves, right? Similarly, if I translate something in space by a constant distance, everything moves. Right, so you don't consider, so no fixed endpoints, no fixed endpoints. Okay, and so what you are really doing is that you consider trajectory one, consider trajectory two, and then, you know, that is t prime. So this is this thing here. Is delta tilde t, right? And then so this will be, you do it the other way, delta of q. But now you move from q of t. So for this is the q of t. This is the q prime, or whatever. Okay, so I move from this guy here, not up by delta tilde, but I move in time as well. So I move over here. Okay, so this is my q prime of t prime. All right, so I move in that direction, but I also move in that direction. And so this thing here is basic, well, this thing here is delta tilde q. So I started with q of t, I end up with q prime of t prime, and this is delta tilde. Okay. So now looking at this picture, you can easily see how, you know, these variations are connected. And you will see that delta tilde q is delta of q plus dq over dt delta tilde t. So the first approximation. So how do I see that? So this is my delta tilde q here. This is my delta q. So the difference is this piece here. And that depends on the derivative of q at that point. So it's dq of dt times that. It's like a tangent or whatever, right? But it's a small, it's infinitesimal, right? So there's a small approximation, small angle approximation. So you happy with this? So, you know, it's geometry. So by the way, this thing here, which I just wrote down, is valid more generally. So I did it for q, right? So I can look at this like an operational identity between, you know, delta tilde, delta, and other things, right? And I applied it to q, to the coordinate. So more generally, what will be true? So more generally, I can replace q with any function of q and q dot and t and whatever, and I get an operational identity between delta tilde and delta. So, and the identity will be delta acting on something will be delta tilde acting something is delta acting on something plus delta tilde t times d over dt. So that's an operational identity which we just seen in the, you know, from the picture. Apply to q, but it'll be true for any function. Okay, this is getting complicated. That's good. But I didn't want to discuss this. Why am I discussing it? Anyway, so we want to describe types of symmetries, but we are already proving the Noether's theorem. But anyway, so this will be useful in a minute. Okay? Yes. Okay, so we had an identity that this guy commutes with d over dt, right? So this guy changes time as well, right? So they will not commute. And the difference is precisely this thing here.
But here you've reversed from the higher line to the lower line the order of the delta.
Oh, no. Sorry. That's a good question. Thank you for that question. So remember, you know, so what you are doing is that there's a like one term, which is dq over dt. And then you multiply that by delta tilde t, right? So yeah, they are taking the derivative here, is dq over dt, and multiplying by this distance over here, and that gives you that piece over there, right? So you know, this thing here is just a term which I can put here. But what is important is like that d over dt acts on this q. And so d over dt will act on any function. Okay, sorry. So what are the types of symmetries? Okay, so now we are almost ready. So we understand what delta tilde is. And that is different from the delta used in equations of motion. So now we consider the transformations which I just wrote down. And the question is, you know, when this transformation will be global and continuous, right? And to that piece, I'll make it even more complicated. So next, write, you know, this delta tilde q as epsilon times delta q. It's a stupid notation. I'm sorry for that. I still haven't found a better notation for this. Okay. So what I mean by this, so I write delta tilde q and delta tilde t as some parameter epsilon times something what I'm doing with time. So this is the parameter, how much I'm moving in time. For example, I'm moving 5 seconds in time. Okay, so epsilon tells me how much you move. How much you move. Or I am, you know, translating everything by 1 meter, right? So the fact that this 1 meter is described by this epsilon, no? By the parameter. And then this delta t and delta q are the generators telling me what I'm actually doing. What am I doing? I am doing. So for example, I will have a if I want to describe the translation in time, I will not be doing anything with the coordinates. So this will be 0, right? And then I will just say, well, I'm moving in time, so this will be 1. And then I'm moving in time by the epsilon by 5 seconds, right? If I'm moving in space, I don't do anything with time. So this will be 0, so delta t is 0. And I'm moving, let's say, in the x direction. So delta q will be like 1, 0, 0, 0 vector. I'm moving in the x direction and by 3 meters, something like that. Right? So I'm just decomposing what kind of transformation. So basically, these generators are supposed to tell you what kind of transformation you are doing. And they can be vectors or whatever, or rotation. I'm doing rotation. And this is how much you are doing of the transformation.
Is it the same parameter for q and t?
You're right. So it should be different. I can move one centimeter in space, and I can, yeah, so this could be different. Yeah, different.
What did you write beneath the word parameter? I can't
see. So this is the parameter, how much you move. Oh, okay. And this is, you know, what you are doing. What is your move, right? OK, and so now we can have symmetries are either discrete or continuous. And they are discrete if, they are continuous if epsilon can be anything, be sufficiently small. Okay, so for example, stupid example, I have a circle and I rotate it by some angle epsilon. And I know that, you know, I map the circle to itself, or no matter how small the epsilon is, right? Or, you know, how big the epsilon is. But epsilon can be anything, right? It's a continuous parameter, and it will still be a symmetry of the circle, right? On the other hand, if I have a lattice with the atoms spaced by the distance a or something like that, I can map the lattice to itself, but my translation of the lattice cannot be infinitesimally small. Epsilon has to be actually equal to multiple of a, right? So this will be an example. So epsilon is a multiple of a. So it is not a continuous symmetry. It is a discrete symmetry. I have to move it by a finite number. So epsilon is finite. OK? So you can distinguish, you know, symmetries are either discrete or continuous. Another theorem speaks about the continuous symmetries. Okay, so where is it? So if you look at the formulation, it says for every global continuous symmetry, so we have to have continuous symmetries, not the discrete ones. For the discrete symmetries, there are no Noether charges. There's still something. I don't know if you used to study condensed matter physics. There's like Bloch's theorem and stuff like that. But it's not really a Noether charge. Okay, so only for continuous symmetry. So these are interesting ones. And then it says global or local. So symmetries, again, can be global or local. So global means that the epsilon is actually equal to a constant. So if I move everything by 1 meter, and it's a symmetry of my system, then I have a global symmetry. Okay. On the other hand, I can have, I you know, in order this to be symmetry, I consider the motion dependent on, let's say, time, right? So that would be a local symmetry, right? So epsilon is t, so this would be a local symmetry. Sometimes these things are called gauge symmetries. So the Noether's theorem about the conserved charges deals with the global symmetries. You have to be able to translate everything in time by 1 meter, or, you know, by constant, or, you know, rotate by a constant angle and stuff like that. If your Lagrange is independent or whatever, your action is independent on epsilon, which is a function of time, then you have different kind of symmetry. It's a local symmetry, gate symmetry, and, you know, this Noether theorem does not apply. There's a different Noether's theorem which applies, and basically it gives you, it doesn't give you conserved charges, it gives you, so this type of symmetries, local ones, it's a subject of second Noether's theorem, which we are not going to discuss. And basically it doesn't lead to conserved charges, but it leads to Bianchi identities. And Bianchi identities are basically additional constraints of your, which are valid in addition to equations of motion. Okay, so they are very powerful. And they constrain your solutions. But basically, what you are telling is that you are dealing with an overdetermined system. You have to, so you are using for your description more degrees of freedom than actually 2 degrees of freedom. And all nice field theories will be like that. So Maxwell theory is a gauge theory. Gravity is a gauge theory because we will have, you know, Bianchi identities, because we will have a huge gauge symmetry present in these theories. Okay, but let's not go there. Let's just do. Okay. So we already know. So we know what the global and what a continuous symmetry is. So we understand this theorem now. Okay, and the statement is for every such symmetry, there will be this corresponding integral of motion. Oh, very good. So now that's very good. We know that there will be, but how does it look like? Okay. And so let me give you a messy, explicit version of this Noether theorem, which actually tells you how to find this integral of motion. Questions?
Yes, actually. I'm wondering how fundamental these symmetries are, because like local symmetries, they depend on the, again, on the coordinate that we choose, because it's just epsilon of t. And then we may move to a coordinate that we don't really have this local symmetry. Are these like fundamental symmetries of our system, or they can be just a matter of gauge as well, like we see in electromagnetism?
Well, I don't know. So think about electromagnetism. When you talk about, you know, gauge symmetries and stuff like that, it's best to think about Maxwell's theory right? So now you know that Maxwell's theory is a theory of a photon or whatever, and that you can have two polarizations, two electromagnetic waves, right? So you can have, you know, this and that or whatever polarization, right? So you have really only 2 degrees of freedom in the Maxwell's theory, right? But you describe your Maxwell's theory in terms of the four potential. You have the scalar potential phi, and then you have the vector potential A. So you are describing it in terms of four variables, right? So basically, you haven't eliminated all the constraints. So your theory is a gauge theory because you haven't fixed the gauge. You haven't fixed what these vector potentials have to be or whatever, right? And there's many advantages why you don't want to fix that, why you don't want to fix the gauge. So you know, in order, you know, the nice symmetries, other symmetries of the theory are apparent. In order to write beautiful equations of motion, like, you know, Maxwell equations and whatever, then you know you don't want to fix the gauge, okay? Because otherwise you lose the apparent symmetries, other symmetries, and nice properties.
Does it mean that the symmetries are real because they depend on the coordinate again? We may move to a coordinate that we see this gauge.
It's not moving into a different coordinate system. It's eliminating some degrees of freedom, if you want. It's fixing the gauge. So you can eliminate the gauge symmetry by fixing the gauge, by, you know, choosing what that my scalar potential is zero and that my vector potential satisfies, I don't know, radiation gauge and stuff like that, right? And then, you know, once you fix the gauge, when you say, well, once I get rid of, once I go from 4 degrees of freedom to 2, then I fix the gauge. I no longer have this gauge symmetry, but I only work with 2 real degrees of freedom. Right, so it's like the gauge symmetry is like really I want to work with more degrees of freedom than there are actually number of 2 degrees of freedom.
looking at the right window.
Ah? And you know, sometimes this is useful and sometimes it is not useful. And you know, for concrete calculations, you typically want to choose a concrete gauge. If you want to calculate something in relativity, you want to, you know, work in Schwarzschild coordinates, and you know, you want to fix the gauge as much as possible and write down the metric explicitly and stuff like that. But for, you know, to discovering the general features of the theory, it's much better not to fix the gauge and see, you know, what the theory looks like without fixing the gauge. And sometimes, you know, for one problem you fix the gauge this way, for a different problem you fix the gauge that way. You know, that's much better than just fixing from the very beginning and working in that gauge all the time.
I don't know if this was Sava's original question, but or is this, I don't know, something I'm confused about. If you say have, you know, your, you know, theory of electromagnetism, right? You've got Maxwell's equations, and it's got a gauge, right? What if you intentionally change coordinates? Does that gauge still kind of stay as the same gauge? Like, do you still have that gauge? It's, the gauge is not coordinate dependent.
Well, it depends on which theory you are using and, you know, what exactly you are doing. So we will see many examples in this course when we actually, you know, we'll be enlarging the system and, you know, making for it to have gauge symmetry and stuff like that. So you know, you will see many explicit examples when we discuss this. So just wait. Probably till next week, and there will be some nice example.
I got the impression that every local symmetry is equivalent to a gauge symmetry, right?
Yeah.
So I think we can constrain the gauges so we could eliminate them, right, all the time. So, following up on Sabot's question, if we change the coordinates to some new coordinate, we could possibly remove all the gauges. So gauge symmetries are not. I got this impression that gauge symmetries are not as important as global, because you could just choose the coordinate that in which you just have global symmetries.
Okay, so let yeah.
I got the impression that global symmetries are a little bit more fundamental.
They are very different symmetries. Yeah, I agree. So they are very, very different symmetries. The global ones, they are really related to your integrals of motion and stuff like that. The local ones are more like a redundancy in the description of the system.
You just use them to ease the process of calculation or something like that?
Yeah, for example. Yeah. And you know, when you are doing some concrete calculation, you want to fix the gauge anyway, right? So you want to, you know, eliminate the extra degrees of freedom and then really extract something which is, you know, it looks nice in some coordinate system or for some electromagnetic fields and stuff like that. Okay. So let me formulate now the explicit version. Theorem version 2, which is the explicit one. And so let's write. So let's delta tilde, you know, of this form, delta tilde t, delta tilde q, where is it? It's still here. All good. There we go. So, you know, let's say that we find such a transformation of t and q, let's call it delta tilde, which goes like that. So let this delta tilde be a global continuous symmetry.
Before you go on, can I ask another question?
Yes.
So we discussed that, and I think you agreed with me that local symmetries are not as important as the global, but we have experience like R and R poles effect, in which the symmetry is a consequence of the electromagnetic potential. But electromagnetic potential is, I think, it has a gauge symmetry, right?
But as far as I know, that's only true at the quantum level. So you know, at you know, things, so certainly you have a gauge symmetry at the, you know, classical level. It's just a choose of coordinates, right? And you know, I'm choosing two extra coordinates. But you know, it may be the case that, you know, some of these symmetries become something else when you actually, you know, quantize the system and stuff like that. Yeah. So they may have some. Okay, so let delta tilde be a global continuous symmetry, which means that is of shell till we find delta tilde q and delta tilde t such that when I plug them into the action, I find that it's equal to zero, the variation of the action, zero. Then the statement is, you will find an integral I, which is given by this formula here, delta tilde u plus l minus q dot dl over dq dot delta tilde t is n on shell integral of motion. Okay, well, this is a very explicit version. So I'm telling you, well, okay, so I'm given the Lagrangian or whatever, the system, and somebody gives me, you know, this delta tilde q and this delta tilde t, such that if I vary the action with respect to these things, and I'm not using the equations of motion, so it has to be off shell, it has to be really symmetry of the action. And for finding the symmetry, I'm not using the equations of motion, right? So then I find that this is true. And the statement is, well, very simple. So then this guy here will be an integral of motion. Okay. And integral of motion only makes sense on shell, so it will be an on-shell integral of motion, right? All right, so where the devil is here, just a second, is that really, you know, there is no prescription how to find this delta tilde q and this delta tilde t so that this is true, right? So if you are lucky, you guess what this delta tilde q and what this delta tilde t is, or somebody gives you, God gives you, or you dream about it at night, whatever. But you know, there is no prescription how to find these. But once you have those and check that this is true, this is your integral of motion, okay? So it's not constructive, but it's, you know, what was the question?
So it's maybe getting ahead a little bit, but could you explain sort of intuitively what this may mean? Because like the Lagrangian minus q dot dot dl dq dot is just the Hamiltonian, right? So, and the dl by dq dot is going to be your conjugate momentum as well. So I'm just trying to think of like, what is
yeah, that? Yeah, no, this is very good. I will give you an example just in 1 minute, okay? So yeah, you're guessing exactly right. So you know, if I just consider translations in time, right? My system is invariant with respect to translations in time. I'm not doing anything with the space, so this term is gone, right? I'm translating in time, so this will be epsilon times delta t, whatever. So yeah, so this will be one, right? Translating in time, and this is a conserved energy, right? Precisely. Yeah, exactly. So you just spoiled my example. So example, two simple examples. So first, what we just discussed, so time translation symmetry, which means I can actually, you know, translate time into the future. And this will be true is when L is not an explicit function of time, okay? So it does depend on time through q and q dot, but does not depend explicitly, okay? So that means that is, I can find this transformation, delta t is epsilon equals to constant, and then delta tilde q equals to zero, okay? So up to you, or wait for the tutorial number one to show that really, you know, if my Lagrangian does not explicitly depend on time, that I can take this delta tilde t to be constant and this delta tilde q to be zero. And you can show that that it implies the delta tilde s is equal to zero. Okay, so it is a symmetry. It may be obvious. But actually, it takes two lines to show that. Okay, so two lines, not completely obvious. So anyway, so then, of course, if this is true, then your integral of motion pi is typically called E, which is dl over dq dot. Let me restore the index I just to make it more complicated. Minus L is your integral of motion, and it's called generalized energy. And of course, it's connected to the Hamiltonian and so on. Right? So dl over dqi dot. But by the way, here I'm using the Einstein summation convention. So whenever you see repeated index, you sum over that, right? So when they were trying to evaluate the value of Einstein's work, they came up with the idea that Einstein summation convention actually saved so many dollars for the printing of the books that this is his biggest contribution. Okay? So you're summing over here. So it's like sum over I from 1 to n, qi, qi dot. Okay. So that's the generalized energy. You can show that this is actually conserved. So exercise, show that dE over dt equals to 0 using the equations of motion. It's a one-line calculation. You can do that. So show that. And we are running out of time. That's OK. So let me give you the second example. And then maybe next time we will talk about proving this theorem. Example number two is translation symmetry, space translation symmetry, space translation symmetry. And so that's when one of the coordinates, let's say Q, is so-called cyclic coordinate. Which means that the Lagrangian actually does not depend on this particular coordinate. Let's call it QC or whatever. Cyclic. So it is a function of other coordinates, but let's say it's not a function of, let's say, phi. It's a function of, not a function of one coordinate. OK. So then you can check that delta tilde t equals to 0 and delta tilde q equals to epsilon equals to constant, qc equals to constant is a symmetry. And then our beautiful formula just gives us that I, in this case, it's called P, is dl over dq dot, is the generalized momentum. Okay. And so that comes from this formula over here. So delta tilde t is 0, and delta tilde qc. Put the c there if you want to. So you know, if a motion doesn't depend on x, then there will be the corresponding bx conserved. Okay. And of course, you know, the fact that dpc over dt equals to 0 again. Well, it's very simple. Just from the Euler Lagrange equations, we have that, you know, d over dt dl over dq c dot minus dl over dq c equals to 0. But L does not depend on qc. So this term is not there. And so the Euler Lagrange equations immediately tell you that this thing over here is an integral of motion by definition. So here you have the canonical, most simple examples of conserved quantities. And then maybe next time I'll spend 5 minutes trying to show how this formula, the general formula here, comes about. But really, I want to stress that you have a beautiful prescription for the integral of motion, but it's really very difficult sometimes to find what is delta tilde q and what is delta tilde t r, right? And so that's the art which you have to spend your lifetime on to actually find, you know, what this could be, and then there's a beautiful prescription for you. Questions?
What happens if it in the beginning our Lagrangian is not a continuous function and we are not able to do like that kind of derivatives?
You are asking if the Lagrangian is not analytic?
Yeah.
Then you are screwed up, right? So we are in physics, so you want to have everything nice and smooth and differentiable as much as you can. And of course, you know, sometimes there are games you can play with, you know, some derivative games, like it's differentiable twice, but not three times and stuff like that. But you know, in this course, definitely everything is infinitely differentiable and so on. If it's not, you know, it's very subtle. And the question is, like always, you know, mathematicians play with something, but the question is, you know, is it useful, right? Is it right? And so, yeah.
But lots of times we use like potentials that are continuous, like something which is constant at the time, but with
exactly, and it's in a very bad approximation. So you know, I mean, my friend just published a paper about, you know, just the square well in quantum mechanics, which people use in the first year. But actually, it leads to so many contradictories, actually, that it's not a good approximation. You better approximate it with something nice and smooth, right? And so then it actually starts behaving nicely. But if you just have, you know, really sharp edges like that, there are so many pathologies present in the system. So you better avoid them.
But if physics really work discontinuous, what would happen in that case?
I mean, there are examples like, what is it called, Newton's dome or something like that. You have a particle on something which is, I don't know, not differentiable at the top of that, and you know, it can fall down in all directions and at any time and stuff like that. But you know, yes. Okay, let me stop here.